Welcome, everyone, and good afternoon. This is a special day for the Nevada Court of Appeals. In addition to the cases we're arguing, which are obviously very important to the parties here today, it is the first time that Judge Deborah Westbrook will be appearing in court as a member of the Nevada Court of Appeals. So we welcome Judge Westbrook. She was elected in November, took office on January 2nd, and this is our first argument since she's on the bench. So do you know what that means? She's super prepared. And to my left is Judge Bonnie Bulla, who's been on the court since 2019, and myself since 2015. Since this is an important day, I'll just recount history for a moment. We had our first oral argument when the Court of Appeals was formed in March of 2015. And at that time, the proceedings were filmed and a lot of people had cameras. And it was a pretty momentous event because Nevada didn't have a Court of Appeals in its history until then. So, counsel, you don't have any advance notice of this, but I'm going to ask if anyone has any objection to cameras in the courtroom today or any other recording of the proceedings. Okay, so we have Mr. Klein appearing for the appellant, Ms. Shahed, and Mr. Jones appearing for the respondent, Mr. Abraham. And this is officially case number 82749-COA. So the proceedings have begun. Counsel have indicated they have no objection to cameras in the courtroom or any filming. So that request for me is granted. And we have some staff members and other friends of the court that are here, and feel free to take any pictures. And if counsel wouldn't mind, and maybe we can get some pictures with you when we're done with the proceedings. Okay, so Judge Bullitt, you're now the person with the second longest tenure on the court. Do you have anything you'd like to say to counsel today before we start?
Welcome. Thank you so much for taking a pro bono case today. It means a lot to us to have the bar active in this area, and it certainly means a lot to your clients, some of whom could not afford representation. It also gives you the opportunity sometimes to take a case in an area of law that you would not otherwise be able to practice in. So we're very appreciative of all your hard work. Thank you.
Thank you. And Judge Westbrook, I'm sure you have a few comments of welcome to everyone, and maybe you could tell us how you feel actually sitting here instead of standing at that lectern or sitting at one of those tables like you did for so many years.
Well, I will just say thank you so much, Chief and Judge Bulla. And it's an honor to be here today for my first oral argument. I'll just let you know, my feet actually don't touch the ground. When I'm sitting up here, I have to be kind of up a little bit high, so it's sort of an interesting experience sitting up here on the bench. My first participation in the argument, so I may be as nervous as you guys. But I just, you know, I want to thank you again for taking the pro bono cases. As Judge Bulla mentioned, it's a really important aspect of, you know, our service to be able to commit to pro bono. And I'm glad that you guys are here. I also want to welcome Sung Cho, who is here visiting to see her first oral argument. She's planning to go to law school and get an idea for what it is that we do here in the legal profession. And I also want to welcome my court staff. I have Travis Studdard, I have Alyssa Williams, and then I have Kelsey Bernstein, all from my chambers here to watch me and my first presiding over an oral argument. So thank you.
Right. Can you relax a little bit now? So this is also being broadcast. I have one staff member here and two more in Carson City, but actually people can watch this from anywhere. So you might not realize that these are broadcast proceedings and they are recorded. That's why we have the IT staff here. So thank you again, as my colleagues have said, for counsel being willing to take a case through the pro bono program. We get a lot of family law cases, but this case has a different issue than what we normally see. So it makes for an exciting argument, we're hoping today. So for the appellant obviously goes first. There's 15 minutes. Is there any time, Mr. Klein, you would like to reserve or rebuttal? Okay, so you have to watch yourself. If there are too many questions and it goes too long, maybe we'll add some time. But for right now, just plan on the 11 and 4.
I did want to ask, I was informed that the court may have some sort of indication that my time has lapsed after the first 11 minutes.
Right. Well, it should be a light there on the lectern. So it's I asked that question in part so our staff will know when to give you the signal. And then, of course, there's a clock that would be counting down, too. All right. Are you ready to proceed, Mr. Klein?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. Please do.
Okay, I see the 15 minutes here. Yeah, proceed.
Please.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chief Justice and Justices. I'm Attorney Nicholas Klein, appearing on behalf of Appellant Naheed Jahid. The issue in this case is whether there were any questions of fact raised in my client's opposition to summary judgment. The Supreme Court in Williams requires there to be a good faith belief that you're married at the time of the ceremony. And respondent says that my client could not have had a good faith belief at the time of the ceremony. Yet we have undisputed facts. There was a ceremony attended by at least 100 family and members and friends. We also have emails from the respondent to his employer introducing Naheed as his wife. At the company Christmas party.
Mr. Klein, I'm going to interrupt you.
Yes,
right away. Would you agree that your client understood at the time of the ceremony that a marriage license was required to have a valid marriage under Virginia law?
Could you repeat the question, Your Honor?
Certainly. Would you agree that your client, Ms. Jahid, understood at the time of the ceremony that a marriage license was required to have a valid marriage under Virginia law?
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree that. The point that we want to raise to the court's attention here and that we believe the district court erred on is that under Virginia law, that license was not required to be necessarily obtained prior to a ceremony.
And that's the Levick case, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
But is it correct that in Levick, the parties eventually did obtain a marriage license within approximately 2 weeks and validated the marriage and the ceremony?
That is correct,
Your Honor. That did not happen here, did it?
Correct, Your Honor. And that is why there needs to be a trial on this issue. Now, it is not disputed there was not obtained a marriage license. There are allegations of fraud raised by Ms. Naheed in the representations of respondent in the district court pleadings, but the license was intended to be got afterwards. The fact that it was not is why we're on a putative spouse claim here as opposed to some other claim or a divorce contested proceeding.
But under Virginia law, both parties have to sign the license, as does the officiant, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. And
so what good faith belief did your client have that a license would be obtained when she wasn't participating in that process?
So, Your Honor, that is where, I find that the case law we cite in our brief can clarify that it could arise, a putative spouse claim and a good faith belief can arise where there's a mistake of law or a mistake of fact. Now, whether my client was aware of the fact that a marriage license need be obtained, her participation or signature in the matter, that is an issue that we don't know. There are photographs, there's videotapes of Ms. Jahed signing the marriage certificate proffered by the religious official and then being told that there had to be a marriage license obtained later.
But the parties were aware of that before the ceremony, right? I mean, that's why they went to try to obtain the marriage license, but unfortunately there was a storm and the courthouse was closed. So they at least knew prior to the ceremony that they needed to obtain a license, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. So they did know that they needed to obtain the license. And the point I'm trying to bring here is whether my client knew that she physically had to sign that document, that's a separate question that I suppose was not determined. Her mental state was such that she was a newlywed. She had, there's a wedding attended by all her family and friends. She's somewhat in the honeymoon phase. And her husband, her intended husband, her husband here, had made promises to her that he would obtain the license, that he would ensure that things got done. Taking into consideration their Islamic background, their religious values, their cultural values, that promise is something that she did not have a reasonable, you know, a reason to question. She understood that her husband would get that done. Whether that would occur 2 weeks later, 2 months later, and whether Nahid knew how quickly after the ceremony getting the license, you know, should be done is another question of fact that we would expect the district court to determine.
I have a quick question. So one of the findings of fact that the court made was, and this was the second one listed, on, and it looks like page 1261 of the record, defendant Nahid Jahed admits that a nikah does not create a legally valid marriage. Would you agree with that finding of fact?
Your Honor, I would agree with, I believe, the caveat that the literal translation or the literal transcription of that record was necessarily. A nikah is a religious ceremony, much like, you know, any other religion may have additional tenets on top of the fundamental. There has to be a witness, there has to be an officiant, it has to be publicly declared. A nikah does not necessarily establish the couple are married in the eyes of the state. However, you know, as a practicing Muslim myself, I can state that this is the norm, that people in America, that Muslim couples in America, they have the nikah ceremony, which indicates it conforms to their religious beliefs, that in the eyes of God, this couple is married. Then, as the imam here notified to the parties, in order to be recognized in the state's eyes as legally married, you must obtain a license and et cetera, et cetera.
So then you do dispute that factual finding based on the language in the deposition saying necessarily?
I don't dispute that was her deposition testimony. I dispute that it's being construed in a way that she did not intend it to be, that she recognized that a nikah does not create a Virginia marriage, but a nikah does create an Islamic marriage, Your Honor.
Let me ask this question. Certainly the nikah could have been created as a valid marriage ceremony as long as the license was obtained. And isn't that the Levick case where the Virginia Supreme Court recognized that they could validate a marriage after the ceremony as long as the license was obtained? But again, I just want to make sure your position is that your client relied on Mr. Abraham to obtain that license, and she thought that it had been taken care of. Is that generally the position of the appellant?
That is generally the position of the appellant, Your Honor, that Nahid had relied on the representations made by her husband. She just went through this cultural and religious experience with this ceremony that transformed them from single persons in the eyes of God to married persons in the eyes of God, that he had made representations. Now, whether the district court looks at her, at Naheed's conduct 1 week, 2 weeks, 1 month, 2 months after to determine at what point does it not become reasonable, at what point would that end a putative marriage, that's not what we saw in the district court record. The issue is that in Williams, it's explicitly clarified that at the time of the wedding ceremony is the evaluation of whether or not there's a good faith belief. And additionally, Your Honor, whether or not there was a valid ceremony. I want to briefly, you know, mention that this marriage ceremony was, I don't see any dispute in Virginia law, which is where the ceremony took place, whether this was a proper marriage ceremony. It met the requirements of having the officiant, the witnesses. It was public. They're very simple requirements to meet, and any religious ceremony likely could meet the requirement for a lawful wedding ceremony.
So you're suggesting that a proper marriage ceremony is distinct from a valid marriage ceremony, that the proper marriage ceremony occurred through the religious proceedings, and that's all that's necessary. We don't need to be concerned about the license to constitute a proper marriage ceremony?
No, Your Honor. To clarify my position, the proper marriage ceremony outlined in Williams, our position is it has the elements of a marriage ceremony required by the state in which it's consummated. Now that ceremony, there's been, you know, the parties met all the requirements under Virginia law in addition to the requirements they had for their religious beliefs to constitute a proper ceremony in Islam and a valid ceremony under Virginia law.
Without the marriage license on the day of the ceremony?
Correct, Your Honor. And that was the Levitt case. So the marriage ceremony in and of itself does not require a license under Virginia law on the day of the ceremony to be obtained. So that ceremony was valid at the time of the ceremony, which is the time capsule that we're looking at in Williams. So we're looking at the time of the ceremony, did one or both of the parties have a good faith belief? If one of the parties understood that a license could be obtained after that ceremony, they have no reason to doubt that having the ceremony without the license.
This is in a case where there was a pre-existing legal impediment to the marriage, though, is there?
I see my time has expired, Your Honor. May I conclude responding to your question? And you're asking about the Levitt case?
Well, there's no legal impediment. There was no legal impediment to this marriage taking place, assuming that the ceremony was performed and a license was obtained.
Correct, Your Honor. On the day of the ceremony in Virginia, this couple had no reason to believe that there was a legal impediment to the ceremony.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Right. I have 3.5 minutes left when we get to the rebuttal. All right, and we'll turn to the respondent, represented here by Mr. Jones.
Thank you very much, Chief Judge, judges. May it please the court. The questions that were asked already kind of stole a little bit of my thunder, but I guess that's never a bad thing. My voice has always been known to carry, so I'm going to try to stay away from the microphone a little bit. There is no dispute that under the law, a nikah ceremony is not sufficient to create a legal marriage. That has been acknowledged in court by the appellant throughout these proceedings, and it's also consistent with basically family law throughout the 50 states. The question that was asked about the fact that she was trying to get a marriage license, that tells you that she knew she needed it for the wedding. They knew they needed it for the wedding. Yes, a storm prevented them from obtaining it prior to, but another fact that it's part of the record, and it was something that was filed by a counsel for appellant on the day before trial, is at 6 ROA 1238. The imam offered an affidavit in which he specifically says, I and my assistant did emphasize the requirement of registering the marriage with the court over text and email several times. He says that he agreed to do it on the understanding that they would eventually obtain, that he would do the ceremony on the understanding that they would eventually obtain the license necessary to make it a marriage. Okay. When you talk about whether it's reasonable to believe that you are legally married, that is obviously one consideration under Williams. But as I prepared for this, while I don't think it's reasonable if you're driving in a snowstorm, and it wasn't that the snowstorm prevented them from getting to the courthouse, it was then they actually drove through the snowstorm, and the courthouse was closed. So if you're going out on the eve of your wedding to obtain the license, it's clear that you knew you needed the license. Otherwise, no one would have driven out in a snowstorm. Then to be notified by the person conducting the religious ceremony, hey, this isn't valid. Those both go to the issue of good faith. But the bigger issue, I think, that both factors go to is the fact that once a spouse under Waldman, and this is clear, you can argue that issues of good faith require, you know, evidentiary proceedings, or make the arguments that there was a dispute of fact, even though I think on the record the court found that there was not, and for good reason. But when it says once a spouse learns of the legal impediment, the marriage ends. The putative marriage ends on that moment. So when you know prior to the ceremony, and you know at the ceremony, because the imam has told you, this is not a valid marriage legally, and I understand the difference between in the eyes of God, and the difference between that and the eyes of law. And fortunately for me, we are here under the eyes of the law, which you represent for the state of Nevada. But to know that you have a legal impediment prior to the ceremony means that if there was a putative marriage, meaning if there was an analysis of any type of whether there was good faith or not on the part of the appellant for asserting this claim, she also knew, because that was never obtained, that the marriage would have had to have ended on the day it started or, frankly, before it started.
But, Mr. Jones, the problem, I suppose, that we have to address is Virginia law that does allow a marriage to be validated by a marriage license after the ceremony. And as I understand Mr. Hodd's position is that I felt on the day of the ceremony I was entering into a valid marriage. I understood we didn't have a license, but nevertheless, I had a good faith belief that that could be taken care of. And so on the day of the marriage, I thought I was entering into a valid ceremony before, you know, 250 family members and friends. Right. So how do we reconcile that belief with the facts of what happened here?
Well, I think that's where you get into whether or not that belief is reasonable, A. And B, did she then have a duty to do that which was necessary to try to ratify the marriage? And even if it was not legally able to be ratified, i.e. not having a license in advance means not a legal marriage, she would have needed to have tried to ratify it in order to potentially have a valid putative spouse claim. But having done, I don't think she gets to sit on her hands knowing that she needed the license, knowing that the imam told her she needed the license to have a valid marriage, and then enter into the religious ceremony and then do nothing to try to ratify or validate the marriage on her own. I understand that the position taken in the papers and pleadings or after the fact is that, oh, she relied on my husband, on the respondent, to do so. I don't think she gets to do that. I think she had a burden to try to ratify what she already knew was not a valid marriage. But again, That's why I was focused not so much on the good faith belief aspect, but on the, if I know there's a legal impediment on the day I enter into the religious ceremony, hasn't the putative marriage ended immediately?
So do you believe an evidentiary hearing would have been helpful to make these determinations?
I don't. And, you know, summary judgment still exists, although, you know, there are some of us who do nothing but family law who are starting to think that there are no issues that cannot be decided without a trial when it comes to child custody issues. And frankly, I think the leanings of both the appellate court and the Supreme Court are accurate in that regard. Too many substantive constitutional rights were being affected without actually hearing evidence as it pertains to children. But summary judgment as it pertains to legal issues, particularly when you, and I guess, you know, if rather than in her deposition or rather than an affidavit offered by the appellate, she offered this affidavit, which established even further her notice that the marriage was not legally valid. I think once you have that type of fact where the marriage would end before it started, in the analysis under Williams and pretty much all the putative spouse cases throughout the country, you know, once somebody knows of a legal impediment, the marriage ends. The putative marriage ends, period.
But Ms. Jaha's position is she did not really understand this until the birth of their daughter in the hospital, when Mr. Abraham had to sign a certificate that he was the father of the child. So how do we reconcile that position?
Well, when she was applying for Medicaid, you know, signing under oath with the state of Nevada, you know, there's an estoppel issue, a potential judicial estoppel issue, when you sign under oath that you are an unmarried person for the purpose of obtaining state benefits. I think that has to factor into any analysis on a summary judgment level as well, where she herself represented herself to the state of Nevada to be a single person.
So, Mr. Jones, you're identifying various dates where she could have known conclusively that it was not a valid marriage. But let's say the date in question, hypothetically, was a week later. They had an appointment to go to the courthouse a week after the wedding. During that 1 week period, would it have been okay if they go to the courthouse and say, oh, we're not going to get married after all, forget about the license? But up until that point, they thought they were going to get a license. So would you have a putative marriage for a week?
I don't think you would have a putative marriage until you've remedied it, like in the case cited, that you pointed out, for the name Klavik, you know, that was where both parties took the effort after the fact to try, you know, to obtain the license and ratified and then continued on their lives as if that was a ratification and created a legal marriage, even though it didn't. So in this case, had they actually gone and gotten the license, okay, and legally believed that having that license created a valid marriage, then I think you have a putative spouse argument.
So you're saying getting the license ultimately is required for this doctrine to be in effect?
Well, when the entire tenet of a putative spouse claim, which, as we know, and I was taught a long time ago never to mention public policy in a appellate court argument, but you know, we have public policy in favor of valid marriages. So the reason you have the requirements to have a valid legal marriage is to support that public policy, and our legislature supported it, and all of our case law supports the concept that a valid marriage is something to be revered. In this case, if you know you don't have a valid marriage because you tried to get the certificate and failed, that's the legal impediment. And so when we focus on the learning of the legal impediment to a valid marriage being the terminus point of a putative marriage, that at that point, she couldn't have had a good faith. So the actual ending of the marriage by virtue of not having the certificate also shows that she couldn't have a good faith belief that she was married. Otherwise, why was she driving in a snowstorm to get a license?
Does it make any difference that the district court order says twice that both parties had to have had the belief?
Well, and we addressed that in our brief. previously, the court said one or both. And in another location, she said both. So I believe the court understood it to be one party's belief, legitimate belief.
Well, on page four, it says both, and on page six, it says both.
And we cited in our brief to the location of her saying one or both, because we wanted to address that issue right out of the gate, because it was very clear from the history of the case that the district court judge understood putative spouse doctrine and the case law supporting it. But the March 8th, 2021 order says the doctrine has two elements. Proper marriage ceremony was performed and one or both of the parties. So if she then later, and the citation to that is found on page two of our brief, if it then later only said both, I don't think that undoes the analysis, particularly as clear as it was as to the reasons why summary judgment was appropriate.
Okay. Well, I'm just saying if you thought that that was any impediment, because sometimes a mistaken statement of the law can lead to a case being sent back.
Well, and I do understand that, Your Honor, but I had no doubt that the judge had an understanding of what the law required. And if you look at the factual analysis and the findings she made, it was clearly aimed at one party, not both parties. So I understand, and that's why we addressed that as a harmless error issue, because the analysis is spot on for one party, and she used the correct citation at least once in the order. It just didn't appear in two others.
So essentially your position is that Ms. Shahed knew on the day of the wedding they didn't have a license. She had to have a license. That's it. That's the key fact in the case. Everything else that happens after that is just corroborating or supporting evidence in some way, but it doesn't really even matter because we look at what happened on the day of the wedding.
And that's it's a simplification, meaning if you try to boil it down to the, I always try to offer the single easiest and most logical approach to an issue that can be, you know, complicated as this one can be. And that's why in my argument, my focus was she knew on the day of marriage, and because that is the terminus date of any putative spouse claim, it couldn't be a good faith belief in the 16 months following before the birth of the child.
This is a sort of off the wall question here, but the only thing in front of us is the validity of the wedding. And when we're having the summary judgment was granted and appeals on that, what about the rest of the case? I mean, what happened to it? I mean, why are we here? Usually on a summary judgment, it's not brought until all issues are resolved in the proceeding.
Well, the only other issue that remained, I believe, was child support. That was litigated the day of trial. That was set. The decision from summary judgment was issued the evening prior or the afternoon prior. In fact, I think both counsel hadn't received it until the morning of trial. But that was really the only reason the case was being litigated in the first place. It was this idea that even though I knew that I needed a marriage license and I knew I didn't obtain it and I knew the reasons why I didn't obtain it were, you know, an act of interestingly enough, an act of God, since we were talking about the distinction between in the eyes of the religious people and in the eyes of the law, that is the most simple way to approach both the good faith issue and the termination issue. Because if it terminates on the day, there can't be the creation of quasi-community property. There can't be any issues created for which the district court would need to weigh in based upon evidence.
Do my colleagues have anything else? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Go back to the appellant for Mr. Klein.
Thank you, Your Honor. So, respondent, you know, argues that the fact that they did not have a license at the time of the ceremony, that they tried to get it before the ceremony, somehow invalidates the entire ceremony, despite the fact that they could have gotten it afterwards. I mirror what I interpret to be the court's confusion in that argument, but it is our position certainly that where something can be done later, you're not in foul territory at that point.
But Mr. Klein, it wasn't done later, though. That's the problem with this particular case, unlike Lovick. The parties did not go back and obtain a marriage license. And I can't recall specifically. I think it's approximately, a year and a half, 3 years, that at least a year and a half before their child was born, that your client's position, at least, is that putative spouse should apply during that period of time. But, and we'll mention public policy again, is there not a concern that by upholding the doctrine for that period of time, this court is really being asked to extend the doctrine to allow a common law marriage for 18 months? Because neither Virginia nor Nevada recognize common law marriages. So isn't that a legitimate concern that the court could have? And how would you respond to that?
Your Honor, I would respond with, I believe, one of the concluding statements in Williams. The sanctity of marriage is not undermined, but rather enhanced by recognition of the putative spouse doctrine. As a matter of Virginia law, there's nothing at the time of the ceremony that was uncurable. There's nothing that made it an improper ceremony. That was one of the elements of a lawful marriage. Now, whether there are findings of fact later at a trial that determine the credibility of a reasonable belief of Nahid following that ceremony, following whether or not she did rely on and what her mental state was, given the broader implications of her cultural background, her religious background, the mental state is a question of fact. And that's something that I believe Williams truly stands for, that this good faith belief is presumed, to mention the burdens that, you know, were not addressed here as well, but the good faith belief is presumed. I didn't see any findings in the order that addressed the burden that respondent had to even prove bad faith, which is, you know, the burden that he had to meet before you can even shift the burden onto Ms. Jahid. So this is not a question of law for summary judgment. Williams' case states that these are questions of fact, the reasonability, the good faith belief. It's undisputed that Nahid was living in Virginia. They met through social media. He flew out to Virginia or drove. I don't know that detail of transportation, but he came out there, he approached her and understood she cannot leave her family home until she was married, and then had a marriage ceremony. I believe my time has expired.
Do you see a red light?
I do. It says time remaining, and then it seemed to go upward, so I don't know if I was expired, but.
Well, we could. I mean, would you guys like to have pictures?
I would.
Any PR.
Yeah.
It's not to make any light at all of the proceedings, but when someone becomes a judge for the first time, it's a big deal.
I appreciate the excellent argument by both of the counsel here today.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Well, and I do have to say, as much as you were trying very hard to give me credit for taking a pro bono case, I'm not on this case pro bono. And since I have a duty of candor to the court, I wanted to make sure, because even though you were both looking at me, he's really the person.
Right.
Well, Mr. Jones, we were thinking of your future case that you were going to take.
Well, if you've ever heard of the Rasmussen versus Hammer case that has plagued the appellate court system for 12 years. I've been on a pro bono case for since 2012, so now 11 years, and it's been on 8 appeals.
It involved the kidnapping of the child to Tennis. So I haven't been troubled much by the pro bono project or Clark County Legal Aid because they know the number of hours I put on that one. But we have plenty of pro bono work that Jones and
well, we certainly appreciate.
I laud my opponent in taking this case.
Well, we appreciate both of your efforts.
Thank you, Mr. Klein, very much.
Of course.
That's one of the great things about the pro bono program. You get to decide which case you'll take. So hopefully you will take some more. All right. We'll take this matter under submission for a written decision at a later time. We'll take a brief break and then the very brief, and then the judges will step out here to meet with counsel.